Everything looked like cheap shit. He said he wished he had $1 million, but he'd pissed all his money away. He said he couldn't hold on to money. It slid off him like water off a greased whore. "Don't be like me when you grow up," he would say, and the girls would laugh. Because whatever else happened to them, they would never be like him, a rope-haired, clownish giant with a cock like a wrinkly old carrot. Oryx said she had many chances to see that old carrot up close, because Jack wanted to do movie things with her when there were no movies. Then he would be sad and tell her he was sorry. That was puzzling.
"You did it for nothing?" said Jimmy. "I thought you said everything has a price."
He didn't feel he'd won the argument about money. He wanted another turn. Oryx paused, lifting the nail polish brush. She looked at her hand.
"I traded him," she said.
"Traded him for what?" said Jimmy. "What did that pathetic prick of a loser have to offer?"
"Why do you think he is bad?" said Oryx. "He never did anything with me that you don't do. Not nearly so many things."
"I don't do them against your will," said Jimmy. "Anyway, you're grown up now." Oryx laughed.
"What is my will?" she said.
Then she must have seen his pained look, so she stopped laughing.
"He taught me to read," she said quietly. "To speak English. And to read English words. Talking first, then reading, not so good at first. And I still don't talk so good, but you always have to start somewhere, don't you think so, Jimmy?"
"You talk perfectly," said Jimmy.
"You don't need to tell lies to me. So that is how. It took a long time, but he was very patient. He had one book. I don't know where he got it, but it was a book for children. It had a girl in it with long braids and stockings. That was a hard word, stockings, who jumped around and did whatever she liked. So this is what we read. It was a good trade, because, Jimmy, if I hadn't done it, I couldn't be talking to you, no?"
"Done what?" said Jimmy. He couldn't stand it. If he had this Jack, this piece of garbage in the room right now, he'd wring his neck like a wormy old sock. "What did you do for him? You sucked him off?"
"Craig is right," said Oryx coldly. "You do not have an elegant mind."
Elegant mind was just math talk. That patronizing jargon that math nerds used, but it hurt Jimmy anyway. No. What hurt was the thought of Oryx and Crake discussing him that way, behind his back. "I'm sorry," he said. He ought to know better than to speak so bluntly to her.
"Now maybe I wouldn't do it. But I was a child then," said Oryx more softly. "Why are you so angry?"
"I don't buy it," said Jimmy. Where was her rage? How far down was it buried? What did he have to do to dig it up?
"You don't buy what?"
"Your whole fucking story, all this sweetness and acceptance and crap."
"If you don't want to buy that, Jimmy," said Oryx, looking at him tenderly, "what is it that you would like to buy instead?"
Jack had a name for the building where the movies went on. He called it Pixieland. None of the children knew what that meant, Pixieland, because it was an English word and an English idea, and Jack couldn't explain it. "All right, pixies, rise and shine," he'd say. "Candy time." He brought candies for them as a treat sometimes. "Want a candy, candy?" he'd say. That also was a joke, but they didn't know what it meant either. He let them see the movies of themselves if he felt like it, or if he'd just been doing drugs. They could tell when he'd been shooting or snorting because he was happier then. He liked to play pop music while they were working. Something with a bounce. Upbeat, he called it. Elvis Presley, things like that. He said he liked the golden oldies from back when songs had words. "Call me sentimental," he said, causing puzzlement. He liked Frank Sinatra, too, and Doris Day. Oryx knew all the words to Love Me or Leave Me before she had any idea what they meant. "Sing us some Pixieland jazz," Jack would say. And so that was what Oryx would sing. He was always pleased. "What was this guy's name?" said Jimmy. What a jerk, this Jack. Jack the jerk, the jerk-off. Name-calling helped, thought Jimmy. He'd like to twist the guy's head off.
"His name was Jack, I told you. He told us a poem about it, in English. Jack be nimble, Jack be quick. Jack has got a big candlestick."
"I mean his other name."
"He didn't have another name."
Working was what Jack called what they did. Working girls, he called them. He used to say, "Whistle while you work." He used to say, "Work harder." He used to say, "Put some jazz into it." He used to say, "Act like you mean it, or you want to get hurt." He used to say, "Come on, sex midgets, you can do better." He used to say, "You're only young once."
"That's all," said Oryx.
"What do you mean, that's all?"
"That's all there was," she said. "That's all there was to it."
"What about, did they ever..."
"Did they ever what?"
"They didn't. Not when you were that young. They couldn't have."
"Please, Jimmy, tell me what you are asking."
Oh, very cool. He wanted to shake her. "Did they rape you?" He could barely squeeze it out. What answer was he expecting? What did he want?
"Why do you want to talk about ugly things?" she said.
Her voice was silvery, like a music box. She waved one hand in the air to dry the nails.
"We should think only beautiful things, as much as we can. There's so much beautiful in the world if you look around. You are looking only at the dirt under your feet, Jimmy. It's not good for you."
She would never tell him. Why did this drive him so crazy? "It wasn't real sex, was it?" he asked. "In the movies, it was only acting, wasn't it?"
"But Jimmy, you should know. All sex is real."
7. Sveltana. Snowman opens his eyes, shuts them, opens them, keeps them open. He's had a terrible night. He doesn't know which is worse, a past he can't regain, or a present that will destroy him if he looks at it too clearly. Then there's the future. Sheer vertigo. The sun is above the horizon, lifting steadily, as if on a pulley. Flattish clouds, pink and purple on top and golden underneath, stand still in the sky around it. The waves are waving, up, down, up, down. The thought of them makes him queasy. He's violently thirsty, and he has a headache and a hollow, cottony space between his ears. It takes him some moments to register the fact that he has a hangover. "It's your own fault," he tells himself. He behaved foolishly the night before. He guzzled, he yelled, he gibbered, he indulged in pointless repinings. Once he wouldn't have had a hangover over so little booze, but he's out of practice now, and out of shape. At least he didn't fall out of the tree. "Tomorrow is another day," he declaims to the pink and purple clouds. But if tomorrow is another day, what's today? The same day as it always is, except that he feels as if he has tongue fur all over his body. A long scrawl of birds unwinds from the empty towers. Gulls, egrets, herons, heading off to fish along the shore. A mile or so to the south, a salt marsh is forming on a one-time landfill dotted with semi-flooded townhouses. That's where all the birds are going. Minnow City. He watches them with resentment. Everything is fine with them, not a care in the world. Eat, fuck, poop, screech, that's all they do. In a former life, he might have snuck up on them, studied them through binoculars, wondering at their grace. No, he never would have done that. It hadn't been his style. Some grade school teacher, a nature snoop, Sally what's-her-name, herding them along on what she called field trips. The compound golf course and lily ponds had been their hunting grounds. "Look! See the nice ducks? Those are called mallards." Snowman had found birds tedious even then, but he wouldn't have wished to harm them. Whereas right now he yearns for a big slingshot. He climbs down from the tree, more carefully than usual. He's still a bit dizzy. He checks his baseball cap, dumps out a butterfly, attracted by the salt, no doubt, and pisses on the grasshoppers, as usual. "I have a daily routine," he thinks. Routines are good. His entire head is becoming one big stash of obsolete fridge magnets. Then he opens up his cement block cache, puts on his one-eyed sunglasses, drinks water from a stored beer bottle. If only he had a real beer, or an aspirin, or more scotch. "Hair of the dog," he says to the beer bottle. He mustn't drink too much water at a time, he'll throw up. He pours the rest of the water over his head, gets himself a second bottle, and sits down with his back against the tree, waiting for his stomach to settle. He wishes he had something to read. To read, to view, to hear, to study, to compile. Rag ends of language are floating in his head. Mephitic, metronome, mastitis, metatarsal, maudlin. "I used to be erudite," he says out loud. Erudite, a hopeless word. What are all those things he once thought he knew? And where have they gone? After a while, he finds he's hungry. What's in the cache, food-wise? Shouldn't there be a mango? No, that was yesterday. All that's left of it is a sticky, ant-covered plastic bag. There's the chocolate energy jolt bar, but he doesn't feel up to that, so he opens the can of Sveltana no-meat cocktail sausages with his rusty can opener. He could use a better one of those. The sausages are a diet brand, beige and unpleasantly soft. Baby's turds, he thinks, but he manages to get them down. Sveltanas are always better if you don't look. They're protein, but they're not enough for him. Not enough calories. He drinks the warm, bland sausage juice, which, he tells himself, must surely be full of vitamins. Or minerals, at least. Or something. He used to know. What's happening to his mind? He has a vision of the top of his neck opening up into his head like a bathroom drain. Fragments of words are swirling down it in a gray liquid he realizes is his dissolving brain. Time to face reality. Crudely put, he's slowly starving to death. A fish a week is all he can depend on, and the people take that literally. It could be a decent-sized fish or a very small one, all spikes and bones. He knows that if he doesn't balance out the protein with starches and that other stuff, carbohydrates, or are those the same as starches? He'll start dissolving his own fat, what's left of it, and after that his own muscles. The heart is a muscle. He pictures his heart, shriveling up until it's no bigger than a walnut. At first, he'd been able to get fruit. Not only from the cans of it, he'd been able to scrounge, but also from the deserted arboretum an hour's walk to the north. He'd known how to find it. He'd had a map then, but it's long gone, blown away in a thunderstorm. Fruits of the World was the section he'd headed for. There'd been some bananas ripening in the tropicals area, and several other things, round, green, and knobbly, that he hadn't wanted to eat because they might have been poisonous. There'd been some grapes, too, on a trellis in the temperate zone. The solar air conditioning was still functioning inside the greenhouse, though one of the panes was broken. There'd been some apricots as well, espaliered against a wall, though only a few, browning where the wasps had eaten into them and beginning to rot. He'd devoured them anyway, also some lemons. They'd been very sour, but he'd forced himself to drink the juice. He was familiar with scurvy from old seafaring movies. Bleeding gums, teeth coming out in handfuls. That hasn't happened to him yet. Fruits of the World is cleaned out now. How long till more Fruits of the World appear and ripen, he has no clue. There ought to be some wild berries. He'll ask the kids about that, the next time they come poking around. They'll know about berries. But though he can hear them farther down the beach, laughing and calling to one another, they don't seem to be coming his way this morning. Maybe they're getting bored with him, tired of pestering him for answers he won't give or that make no sense to them. Maybe he's old hat, an outworn novelty, a mangy toy. Maybe he's lost his charisma, like some shoddy, balding pop star of yesteryear. He ought to welcome the possibility of being left alone, but he finds the thought dispiriting. If he had a boat, he might row out to the tower blocks, climb up, rob nests, steal some eggs, if he had a ladder. No, bad idea. The towers are too unstable. Even in the months he's been here, several of them have come crashing down. He could walk to the area of the bungalows and trailers, hunt for rats, barbecue them over the glowing coals. It's something to consider. Or he could try going as far as the closest module. Better pickings than the trailers because the goodies there had been thicker on the ground. Or one of the retirement colonies, the gated communities, something like that. But he has no maps anymore, and he can't risk getting lost, wandering around at dusk with no cover and no suitable tree. The wolvogs would be after him for sure. He could trap a pigoon, bludgeon it to death, butcher it in secret. He'd have to hide the mess. He has a notion that the sight of full frontal blood and guts might take him over the threshold as far as the children of Crake are concerned. But a pigoon feast would do him a world of good. Pigoons are fat, and fat is a carbohydrate. Or is it? He searches his mind for some lesson or long-lost chart that would tell him. He knew that stuff once, but it's no use. The file folders are empty. "Bring home the bacon," he says. He can almost smell it, that bacon, frying in a pan with an egg, to be served up with toast and a cup of coffee. Cream with that? Whispers a woman's voice. Some naughty, nameless waitress out of a white aprons and feather dusters porno farce. He finds himself salivating. Fat isn't a carbohydrate. Fat is a fat. He whacks his own forehead, lifts his shoulders, spreads his hands. So, wise guy, he says. Next question? Do not overlook a plentiful source of nutrition that may be no farther away than your feet, says another voice, in an annoying, instructive tone he recognizes from a survival manual he once leafed through in someone else's bathroom. When jumping off a bridge, clench your bum so the water won't rush up your anus. When drowning in quicksand, take a ski pole. Great advice. This is the same guy who said you could catch an alligator with a pointed stick. Worms and grubs were what he recommended for a snack food. You could toast them if you wanted. Snowman can see himself turning over logs, but not just yet. There's something else he'll try first. He'll retrace his steps, go back to the rejuvenescence compound. It's a long hike, longer than any he's taken yet, but worth it if he can get there. He's sure there will still be a lot left back there. Not only canned goods, booze as well. Once they'd figured out what was going on, the compound inhabitants had dropped everything and fled. They wouldn't have stayed long enough to clean out the supermarkets. What he really needs is a spray gun, though. With one of those he could shoot pigoons, hold off the wolvogs, and, idea, light bulb overhead, he knows exactly where to find one. Crake's bubble dome contains a whole arsenal, which ought to be right where he left it. Paradise was what they'd named the place. He'd been one of the angels guarding the gate, in a manner of speaking, so he knows where everything is. He'll be able to lay his hands on the necessary items. A quick in-and-out, a snatch-and-grab, then he'll be equipped for anything. But you don't want to go back there, do you? A soft voice whispers. Not particularly. Because? Because nothing. Go on, say it. I forget. No, you don't. You've forgotten nothing. I'm a sick man, he pleads. I'm dying of scurvy. Go away. What he needs to do is concentrate. Prioritize. Whittle things down to essentials. The essentials are, unless you eat, you die. You can't get any more essential than that. The rejuve compound is too far away for a casual day trip. It's more like an expedition. He'll have to stay out overnight. He doesn't welcome that thought. Where will he sleep? But if he's careful, he should be okay. With the can of Sveltana sausages inside him and a goal in sight, Snowman's beginning to feel almost normal. He has a mission. He's even looking forward to it. He might unearth all sorts of things. Cherries preserved in brandy. Dry-roasted peanuts. A precious can of imitation spam, if serendipity strikes. A truckload of booze. The compounds hadn't stinted themselves. You could find the full range of goods and services there, when there were shortages everywhere else. He gets to his feet, stretches, scratches around the old scabs on his back, they feel like misplaced toenails, then walks back along the path behind his tree, picking up the empty scotch bottle he threw down at the Wolvogs the night before. He gives it a wistful sniff, then tosses it and the Sveltana can onto his midden heap of empty containers, where a whole crowd of debauched flies is making merry. Sometimes at night he can hear the rakunks pawing through this private dump of his, searching for a free meal among the leavings of catastrophe, as he himself has often done, and is about to do again. Then he sets about making his preparations. He reties his sheet, arranging it over his shoulders and pulling the extra up through his legs and tucking it in through the belt effect at the front, and knotting his last chocolate energy bar into a corner. He finds himself a stick, long and fairly straight. He decides to take only one bottle of water. Most likely there'll be water along the way. If not, he can always catch the runoff from the afternoon storm. He'll have to tell the children of Crake he's going. He doesn't want them to discover he's missing and set out looking for him. They could run into dangers or get lost. Despite their irritating qualities, among which he counts their naive optimism, their open friendliness, their calmness, and their limited vocabularies, he feels protective towards them. Intentionally or not, they've been left in his care, and they simply have no idea. no idea, for instance, of how inadequate his care really is. Stick in hand, rehearsing the story he'll tell them, he goes along the path to their encampment. They call this path the Snowman Fish Path because they carry his fish along it every week. It skirts the edge of the beach while keeping to the shade. Nevertheless, he finds it too bright and tilts his baseball cap down to keep out the rays. He whistles as he approaches them, as he always does to let them know he's coming. He doesn't want to startle them, strain their politeness, cross their boundaries without being invited, loom up on them suddenly out of the shrubbery, like some grotesque flasher exposing himself to school kids. His whistle is like a leper's bell. All those bothered by cripples can get out of his way. Not that he's infectious. What he's got, they'll never catch. They're immune from him. Purring. The men are performing their morning ritual, standing 6 feet apart in a long line curving off into the trees at either side. They're facing outward, as in pictures of musk oxen, pissing along the invisible line that marks their territory. Their expressions are grave, as befits the seriousness of their task. They remind Snowman of his father heading out the door in the morning, briefcase in hand, and Ernest aiming for the target frown between his eyes. The men do this twice a day, as they've been taught. It's necessary to keep the volume constant, the odor renewed. Craik's model had been the canids and the mustelids, and a couple of other families and species as well. Scent marking was a wide-ranging mammalian leitmotif, he'd said, nor was it confined to the mammals. Certain reptiles, various lizards. Never mind about the lizards, said Jimmy. According to Craik, and Snowman has seen nothing since to disprove it, the chemicals programmed into the men's urine are effective against wolvogs and rakunks, and to a lesser extent against bobkittens and pigoons. The wolvogs and bobkittens are reacting to the scent of their own kind, and must imagine a huge wolvog or bobkitten, from which they would be wise to keep their distance. The rakunks and pigoons imagine large predators, or this was the theory. Craik allotted the special piss to men only. He said they'd need something important to do, something that didn't involve childbearing, so they wouldn't feel left out. Woodworking, hunting, high finance, war, and golf would no longer be options, he'd joked. There are some disadvantages to this plan, in action. The ring of pee boundary line smells like a rarely cleaned zoo, but the circle is large enough so that there's ample smell-free room inside it. Anyway, Snowman is used to it by now. He waits politely for the men to finish. They don't ask him to join them. They already know his piss is useless. Also, it's their habit to say nothing while performing their task. They need to concentrate to make sure their urine lands in exactly the right place. Each has his own 3 feet of borderland, his own area of responsibility. It's quite a sight. Like the women, these men, smooth-skinned, well-muscled, look like statues, and grouped like this they resemble an entire Baroque fountain. A few mermaids and dolphins and cherubs and the scene would be complete. Into Snowman's head comes the image of a circle of naked car mechanics, each holding a wrench. A whole squad of Mr. Fixits, a gay magazine centerfold. Witnessing their synchronized routine, he almost expects them to break into some campy chorus line from one of the seedier nightclubs. The men shake off, break their circle, look over at Snowman with their uniformly green eyes, smile. They're always so goddamn affable. "Welcome, O Snowman," says the one called Abraham Lincoln. "Will you join us inside our home?" He's getting to be a bit of a leader, that one. "Watch out for the leaders," Craik used to say. "First the leaders and the lead, then the tyrants and the slaves, then the massacres. That's how it's always gone." Snowman steps over the wet line on the ground, ambles along with the men. He'd just had a brilliant idea. What if he were to take some of the saturated earth with him on his journey as a protective device? It might ward off the wolvogs. But on second thought, the men would find the gap dug in their defenses and would know he'd done it. Such an act could be misinterpreted. He wouldn't want to be suspected of weakening their fortress, exposing their young to danger. He'll have to cook up a new directive from Craik, present it to them later. "Craik has told me you must collect an offering of your scent. Get them all to piss in a tin can, sprinkle it around his tree, make a fairy ring, draw his own line in the sand." They reach the open space at the center of the territorial circle. Off to one side, three of the women and one man are tending to a little boy, who appears to be hurt in some way. These people are not immune from wounds. The children fall down or bash their heads on trees. The women burn their fingers tending the fires. There are cuts and scrapes. But so far the injuries have been minor, and easily cured by purring. Craik had worked for years on the purring. Once he'd discovered that the cat family purred at the same frequency as the ultrasound used on bone fractures and skin lesions, and were thus equipped with their own self-healing mechanism, he'd turned himself inside out in the attempt to install that feature. The trick was to get the hyoid apparatus modified, and the voluntary nerve pathways connected, and the neocortex control systems adapted without hampering the speech abilities. There'd been quite a few botched experiments, as Snowman recalled. One of the trial batch of kids had manifested a tendency to sprout long whiskers and scramble up the curtains. A couple of the others had vocal expression impediments. One of them had been limited to nouns, verbs, and roaring. "Craik did it, though," thinks Snowman. "He pulled it off. Just look at the four of them now, heads down close to the child, purring away like car engines." "What happened to him?" he asks. "He was bitten," says Abraham. "One of the children of Oryx bit him." "This is something new. What kind?"
"A bobkitten, for no reason." "It was outside our circle. It was in the forest," says one of the women.
"Eleanor Roosevelt? Empress Josephine?" Snowman can't always remember their names. "We were forced to hit it with rocks to make it go away," says Leonardo da Vinci, the man in the purring quartet. "So the bobkittens are hunting kitties now," thinks Snowman. "Maybe they're getting hungry, as hungry as he is himself. But they have lots of rabbits to choose from, so it can't be simple hunger. Maybe they see the children of Craik, the little ones anyway, as just another kind of rabbit, though easier to catch."
"Tonight we will apologize to Oryx," says one of the women.
"Sacagawea?"
"For the rocks. And we will request her to tell her children not to bite us."
He's never seen the women do this communion with Oryx, although they refer to it frequently. What form does it take? They must perform some kind of prayer or invocation, since they can hardly believe that Oryx appears to them in person. Maybe they go into trances. Craik thought he'd done away with all that, eliminated what he called the G-spot in the brain. God is a cluster of neurons, he'd maintained. It had been a difficult problem, though. Take out too much in that area, and you got a zombie or a psychopath. But these people are neither. They're up to something, though. Something Craik didn't anticipate. They're conversing with the invisible. They've developed reverence. Good for them, thinks Snowman. He likes it when Craik is proved wrong. He hasn't caught them making any graven images yet, however.
"Will the child be all right?" he asks.
"Yes," says the woman calmly. "Already the tooth holes are closing. See?"
The rest of the women are doing the things they usually do in the morning. Some are tending the central fire. Others squat around it, warming themselves. Their body thermostats are set for tropical conditions, so they sometimes find it cold before the sun is high. The fire is fed with dead twigs and branches, but primarily with dung, made into patties the size and shape of hamburgers, and dried in the noonday sun. Since the children of Craik are vegetarians and eat mostly grass and leaves and roots, this material burns well enough. As far as Snowman can tell, fire tending is about the only thing the women do that might be classified as work, apart from helping to catch his weekly fish, that is, and cooking it for him. On their own behalf, they do no cooking.
"Greetings, O Snowman," says the next woman he comes to. Her mouth is green from the breakfast she's been chewing.
She's breastfeeding a year-old boy who looks up at Snowman, lets the nipple pop out of his mouth, and begins to cry.
"It's only Snowman," she says. "He won't hurt you."
Snowman still hasn't got used to it, the growth rate of these kids. The yearling looks like a 5-year-old. By the age of 4, he'll be an adolescent. Far too much time was wasted in child-rearing, Craik used to say. Child-rearing and being a child. No other species used up 16 years that way. Some of the other children have spotted him. They come closer, chanting, "Snowman, Snowman." So he hasn't yet lost his allure. Now all the people are gazing at him curiously, wondering what he's doing here. He never arrives without a reason. On his first visits, they'd thought, judging from his appearance, that he must be hungry, and they'd offered him food. A couple of handfuls of choice leaves and roots and grass, and several cecotrophs they'd kept especially for him, and he'd had to explain carefully that their food was not his food. He finds the cecotrophs revolting, consisting as they do of semi-digested herbage, discharged through the anus and re-swallowed two or three times a week. This had been another boy-genius concept on the part of Craik. He'd used the vermiform appendix as the base on which to construct the necessary organ, reasoning that at an earlier evolutionary stage, when the ancestral diet had been higher in roughage, the appendix must have fulfilled some such function. But he'd stolen the specific idea from the Leporidae, the hares and rabbits, which depend on cecotrophs rather than on several stomachs like the ruminants. Maybe this is why Bob kittens have started hunting the young Krakers, Snowman thinks. Beneath the citrus overlay, they can smell the rabbity aroma of the cecotrophs. Jimmy had argued with Craik over this feature. "However you look at it," he'd said, "what it boiled down to was eating your own shit." But Craik had merely smiled. For animals with a diet consisting largely of unrefined plant materials, he'd pointed out such a mechanism was necessary to break down the cellulose, and without it the people would die. Also, as in the Leporidae, the cecotrophs were enriched with vitamin B1, and with other vitamins and minerals as well, at four or five times the level of ordinary waste material. Cecotrophs were simply a part of alimentation and digestion, a way of making maximum use of the nutrients at hand. Any objections to the process was purely aesthetic. "That was the point," Jimmy had said. Craik had said that if so, it was a bad one. Snowman is now surrounded by an attentive circle. "Greetings, children of Craik," he says. "I have come to tell you that I'm going on a journey." The adults must have deduced this already from his long stick and the way he's tied his sheet. He's gone on journeys before, or that's what he's called his looting forays into the trailer parks and adjacent plebelands.
"Are you going to see Craik?" asks one of the children.
"Yes," says Snowman. "I'll try to see him. I'll see him if he's there."
"Why?"
says one of the older children.
"There are some things I need to ask him," says Snowman cautiously.
"You must tell him about the Bob kitten," says Empress Josephine, "the one that bit."
"That is a matter for Oryx," says Madame Curie, "not for Craik."
The other women nod.
"We want to see Craik too," the children begin. "We too, we too, we want to see Craik too."
It's one of their favorite ideas, going to see Craik. Snowman blames himself. He shouldn't have told them such exciting lies at the beginning. He'd made Craik sound like Santa Claus.
"Don't bother, Snowman," says Eleanor Roosevelt gently. "Surely he is making this journey to help us. We must thank him."
"Craik is not for children," says Snowman, looking as stern as he can manage.
"Let us come too. We want to see Craik."
"Only Snowman can ever see Craik," Abraham Lincoln says mildly. That seems to settle it.
"This will be a longer journey," Snowman says. "Longer than the other journeys. Maybe I won't come back for 2 days."
He holds up two fingers.
"Or three," he adds. "So you shouldn't worry. But while I'm away, be sure to stay here in your home and do everything the way Craik and Oryx have taught you."
A chorus of yeses, much nodding of heads. Snowman doesn't mention the possibility of danger to himself. Perhaps it isn't a thing they ever consider, nor is it a subject he brings up. The more invulnerable they think he is, the better.
"We will come with you," says Abraham Lincoln.
Several of the other men look at him, then nod.
"No," says Snowman, taken aback. "I mean, you can't see Craik. It isn't allowed."
He doesn't want them tagging along, absolutely not. He doesn't want them witnessing any weaknesses or failures on his part. Also, some of the sights along the way might be bad for their state of mind. Inevitably, they would shower him with questions. In addition to all of which, a day in their company would bore the pants off him.
"But you don't have any pants," says a voice in his head, a small voice this time, a sad little child's voice. "Joke, joke, don't kill me."
"Please, not now," thinks Snowman, "not in company. In company he can't answer back." "We would come with you to protect you," says Benjamin Franklin, looking at Snowman's long stick. "From the bobkittens that bite,
from the Wolvogs.
Your smell is not very strong, adds Napoleon.
Snowman finds this offensively smug. Also, it's too euphemistic by half. As they all know, his smell is strong enough. It just isn't the right kind.
I'll be fine, he says. You stay here.
The men look dubious, but he thinks they'll do as he says. To reinforce his authority, he holds his watch up to his ear.
Craik says he'll be watching over you, he says, to keep you safe.
Watch? Watching over? Says the small child's voice. It's a pun, you corknut.
Craik watches over us in the daytime, and Oryx watches over us at night, Abraham Lincoln says dutifully.
He doesn't sound too convinced.
Craik always watches over us, says Simone de Beauvoir serenely.
She's a yellow-brown woman who reminds Snowman of Dolores, his long-lost Filipina nanny. He sometimes has to resist the urge to drop to his knees and throw his arms around her waist.
He takes good care of us, says Madame Curie. You must tell him that we are grateful.
Snowman goes back along the snowman fish path. He feels mushy. Nothing breaks him up like the generosity of these people, their willingness to be of help. Also their gratitude towards Craik. It's so touching, and so misplaced.
Craik, you dickhead, he says.
He feels like weeping. Then he hears a voice, his own, saying, boo-hoo. He sees it, as if it's a printed word in a comic strip balloon. Water leaks down his face.
Not this again, he says.
What's the sensation? It isn't anger, exactly. It's vexation. An old word, but serviceable.
Vexation takes in more than Craik, and indeed, why blame Craik alone?
Maybe he's merely envious. Envious yet again. He too would like to be invisible and adored. He too would like to be elsewhere. No hope for that. He's up to his neck in the here and now. He slows to a shamble, then to a halt.
Oh, boo-hoo. Why can't he control himself?
On the other hand, why bother, since nobody's watching? Still, the noise he's making seems to him like the exaggerated howling of a clown, like misery performed for applause.
Stop sniveling, son, says his father's voice. Pull yourself together. You're the man around here.
Right, Snowman yells. What exactly would you suggest? You were such a great example.
But irony is lost on the trees. He wipes his nose with his stick-free hand and keeps walking. Blue. It's 9 in the morning, sun clock, by the time Snowman leaves the fish path to turn inland. As soon as he's out of the sea breeze, the humidity shoots up, and he attracts a coterie of small, green, biting flies. He's barefoot. His shoes disintegrated some time ago, and in any case they were too hot and damp, but he doesn't need them now, because the soles of his feet are hard as old rubber. Nevertheless, he walks cautiously. There might be broken glass, torn metal, or there might be snakes, or other things that could give him a nasty bite, and he has no weapon, apart from the stick. At first, he's walking under trees, formerly parkland. Some distance away, he hears the barking cough of a bob kitten. That's the sound they make as a warning. Perhaps it's a male, and it's met another male bob kitten. There'll be a fight, with the winner taking all the females in the territory, and dispatching their kittens, if he can get away with it, to make room for his own genetic package. Those things were introduced as a control, once the big green rabbits had become such a prolific and resistant pest. Smaller than bobcats, less aggressive, that was the official story about the bob kittens. They were supposed to eliminate feral cats, thus improving the almost non-existent songbird population. The bob kittens wouldn't bother much about birds, as they would lack the lightness and agility necessary to catch them. Thus went the theory. All of which came true, except that the bob kittens soon got out of control in their turn. Small dogs went missing from backyards, babies from prams. Short joggers were mauled. Not in the compounds, of course, and rarely in the modules, but there'd been a lot of grousing from the pleblanders. He should keep a lookout for tracks, and be careful of overhanging branches. He doesn't like the thought of one of those things landing on his head. There are always the Wolvogs to worry about. But Wolvogs are nocturnal hunters, In the heat of the day, they tend to sleep, like most things with fur. Every so often, there's a more open space, the remains of a drive-in campsite with a picnic table and one of those outdoor barbecue fireplaces, though nobody used them very much once it got so warm and began to rain every afternoon. He comes upon one now, fungi sprouting from the decaying table, the barbecue covered in bindweed. Off to the side, from what is probably a glade where the tents and trailers used to be set up, he can hear laughter and singing, and shouts of admiration and encouragement. There must be a mating going on, a rare enough occasion among the people. Craig had worked out the numbers, and had decreed that once every 3 years per female was more than enough. There'll be the standard quintuplet, 4 men and the woman in heat. Her condition will be obvious to all from the bright blue color of her buttocks and abdomen, a trick of variable pigmentation filched from the baboons, with a contribution from the expandable chromospheres of the octopus. As Craik used to say, think of an adaptation, any adaptation, and some animal somewhere will have thought of it first. Since it's only the blue tissue and the pheromones released by it that stimulate the males, there's no more unrequited love these days, no more thwarted lust, no more shadow between the desire and the act. Courtship begins at the first whiff, the first faint blush of azure, with the males presenting flowers to the females, just as male penguins present round stones, said Craik, or as the male silverfish presents a sperm packet. At the same time, they indulge in musical outbursts like songbirds. Their penises turn bright blue to match the blue abdomens of the females, and they do a sort of blue dick dance number, erect members waving to and fro in unison, in time to the foot movements and the singing. A feature suggested to Craik by the sexual semaphoring of crabs. From amongst the floral tributes, the female chooses 4 flowers, and the sexual ardor of the unsuccessful candidates dissipates immediately, with no hard feelings left. Then, when the blue of her abdomen has reached its deepest shade, the female and her quartet find a secluded spot and go at it until the woman becomes pregnant and her blue coloring fades. And that is that. No more no means yes, anyway, thinks Snowman. No more prostitution, no sexual abuse of children, no haggling over the price, no pimps, no sex slaves, no more rape. The 5 of them will royster for hours, 3 of the men standing guard and doing the singing and shouting, while the 4th one copulates, turn and turn about. Craik has equipped these women with ultra-strong vulvas, extra skin layers, extra muscles, so they can sustain these marathons. It no longer matters who the father of the inevitable child may be, since there's no more property to inherit, no father-son loyalty required for war. Sex is no longer a mysterious rite, viewed with ambivalence or downright loathing, conducted in the dark and inspiring suicides and murders. Now it's more like an athletic demonstration, a free-spirited romp. Maybe Craik was right, thinks Snowman. Under the old dispensation, sexual competition had been relentless and cruel. For every pair of happy lovers, there was a dejected onlooker, the one excluded. Love was its own transparent bubble dome. You could see the 2 inside it, but you couldn't get in there yourself. That had been the milder form. The single man at the window, drinking himself into oblivion to the mournful strains of the tango. But such things could escalate into violence. Extreme emotions could be lethal. If I can't have you, nobody will. And so forth. Death could set in. How much misery, Craik said one lunchtime. This must have been when they were in their early 20s and Craik was already at the Watson Crick Institute. How much needless despair has been caused by a series of biological mismatches, a misalignment of the hormones and pheromones, resulting in the fact that the one you love so passionately won't or can't love you. As a species, we're pathetic in that way. Imperfectly monogamous. If we could only pair bond for life like gibbons or else opt for total guilt-free promiscuity, there'd be no more sexual torment. Better plan, make it cyclical and also inevitable, as in the other mammals. You'd never want someone you couldn't have. True enough, Jimmy replied. Or Jim, as he was now insisting, without results. Everyone still called him Jimmy. But think what we'd be giving up. Such as?
courtship behavior. In your plan, we'd just be a bunch of hormone robots. Jimmy thought he should put things in Craig's terms, which was why he said courtship behavior. What he meant was the challenge, the excitement, the chase. There'd be no free choice.
There's courtship behavior in my plan, said Craig, except that it would always succeed. And we're hormone robots anyway, only we're faulty ones.
Well, what about art? Said Jimmy, a little desperately. He was, after all, a student at the Martha Graham Academy, so he felt some need to defend the art and creativity turf.
What about it? Said Craig, smiling his calm smile.
All that mismatching you talk about. It's been an inspiration, or that's what they say. Think of all the poetry. Think Petrarch. Think John Donne. Think the Vita Nuova. Think
art, said Craig. I guess they still do a lot of jabbering about that over where you are. What is it Byron said? Who'd write if they could do otherwise? Something like that?
That's what I mean, said Jimmy. He was alarmed by the reference to Byron. What right had Craig to poach on his own shoddy, threadbare territory? Craig should stick to science and leave poor Byron to Jimmy.
What do you mean? Said Craig, as if coaching a stutterer.
I mean, when you can't get the otherwise, then...
Wouldn't you rather be fucking? Said Craig.
He wasn't including himself in this question. His tone was one of detached but not very strong interest, as if he were conducting a survey of people's less attractive personal habits, such as nose-picking. Jimmy found that his face got redder and his voice got squeakier the more outrageous Craig became. He hated that.
When any civilization is dust and ashes, he said, art is all that's left over. Images, words, music, imaginative structures, meaning. Human meaning, that is defined by them. You have to admit that.
That's not quite all that's left over, said Craig. The archaeologists are just as interested in gnawed bones and old bricks and ossified shit these days. Sometimes more interested. They think human meaning is defined by those things, too.
Jimmy would like to have said, why are you always putting me down? But he was afraid of the possible answers, because it's so easy being one of them. So instead he said, what have you got against it?
Against what? Ossified shit?
Art.
Nothing, said Craig lazily. People can amuse themselves any way they like. If they want to play with themselves in public, whack off over doodling, scribbling, and fiddling, it's fine with me. Anyway, it serves a biological purpose.
Such as? Jimmy knew that everything depended on keeping his cool. These arguments had to be played through like a game. If he lost his temper, Craig won.
The male frog in mating season, said Craig, makes as much noise as it can. The females are attracted to the male frog with the biggest, deepest voice because it suggests a more powerful frog, one with superior genes. Small male frogs, it's been documented, discover that if they position themselves in empty drain pipes, the pipe acts as a voice amplifier, and the small frog appears much larger than it really is.
So?
So that's what art is for the artist, said Craig. An empty drainpipe. An amplifier. A stab at getting laid.
Your analogy falls down when it comes to female artists, said Jimmy. They're not in it to get laid. They gain no biological advantage from amplifying themselves, since potential mates would be deterred rather than attracted by that sort of amplification. Men aren't frogs. They don't want women who are 10 times bigger than them.
Female artists are biologically confused, said Craig. You must have discovered that by now.
This was a snide dig at Jimmy's current, snarled romance, with a brunette poet who'd renamed herself Morgana and refused to tell him what her given name had been, and who was currently on a 28-day sex fast in honor of the great moon goddess Estre, patroness of soybeans and bunnies. Martha Graham attracted those kinds of girls. An error, though, to have confided this affair to Craig. Poor Morgana, thinks Snowman. I wonder what happened to her. She'll never know how useful she's been to me, her and her claptrap. He feels a little paltry for having pawned Morgana's drivel off on Crakers as cosmogony, but it seems to make them happy enough. Snowman leans against a tree, listening to the noises off. My love is like a blue, blue rose. Moon on, harvest shine. So now Craig's had his way, he thinks. Hooray for him. There's no more jealousy, No more wife butcherers, no more husband poisoners. It's all admirably good-natured. No pushing and shoving. More like the gods, cavorting with willing nymphs on some golden age Grecian frieze. Why then does he feel so dejected, so bereft? Because he doesn't understand this kind of behavior? Because it's beyond him? Because he can't jump in? And what would happen if he tried? If he burst out of the bushes in his filthy, tattered sheet, reeking, hairy, tumescent, leering like a goat-bald, cloven-hoofed satyr, or a patch-eyed buccaneer from some ancient pirate film, "Arr, me hearties," and attempted to join the amorous, blue-bottomed tussle. He can imagine the dismay, as if an orangutan had crashed a formal waltz fest and started groping some sparkly pastel princess. He can imagine his own dismay, too. What right does he have to foist his pustulant, cankered self and soul upon these innocent creatures? "Craik," he whimpers, "why am I on this earth? How come I'm alone? Where's my bride of Frankenstein?" He needs to ditch this morbid tape loop, flee the discouraging scene. "Oh, honey," a woman's voice whispers, "cheer up. Look on the bright side. You've got to think positive." He hikes doggedly onward, muttering to himself. The forest blots up his voice, the words coming out of him in a string of colorless and soundless bubbles, like air from the mouths of the drowning. The laughter and singing dwindle behind him. Soon he can't hear them at all. 8. Soyummi. Jimmy and Craik graduated from Healthweiser High on a warm, humid day in early February. The ceremony used to take place in June. The weather then used to be sunny and moderate, but June was now the wet season all the way up the East Coast, and you couldn't have held an outdoor event then, what with the thunderstorms. Even early February was pushing it. They ducked a twister by only one day. Healthweiser High liked to do things in the old style, with marquees and awnings and the mothers in flowered hats and the fathers in panamas, and fruit-flavored punch, with or without alcohol, and happy cup of coffee, and little plastic tubs of Soyummi ice cream, a Healthweiser own brand, in chocolate soy, mango soy, and roasted dandelion green tea soy. It was a festive scene. Craik was top of the class. The bidding for him by the rival edu compounds at the student auction was brisk, and he was snatched up at a high price by the Watson Crick Institute. Once a student there and your future was assured. It was like going to Harvard had been, back before it got drowned. Jimmy, on the other hand, was a mid-range student, high on his word scores but a poor average in the numbers columns. Even those underwhelming math marks had been achieved with the help of Craik, who'd coached Jimmy weekends taking time away from his own preparations. Not that he himself needed any extra cramming. He was some sort of mutant. He could crank out the differential equations in his sleep. "Why are you doing this?" Jimmy asked, in the middle of one exasperating session. "You need to look at it differently. You have to get the beauty of it. It's like chess. Here, try this. See? See the pattern? Now it all comes clear." But Jimmy did not see, and it did not all come clear. "Why help me out?" "Because I'm a sadist," Craik said. "I like to watch you suffer." "Anyway, I appreciate it," said Jimmy. He did appreciate it, for several reasons. The best being that because Craik was known to be tutoring him, Jimmy's dad had no grounds for nagging. If Jimmy had been from a module school, or, better, from one of those dump bins they still called the public system, he'd have shone like a diamond in a drain. But the compound schools were awash in brilliant genes, none of which he'd inherited from his geeky, cack-hearted parents, so his talents shrank by comparison. Nor had he been given any extra points for being funny. He was less funny now, anyway. He'd lost interest in the general audience. After a humiliating wait while the brainiacs were tussled over by the best edu-compounds and the transcripts of the mediocre were fingered and skimmed and had coffee spilled on them and got dropped on the floor by mistake, Jimmy was knocked down at last to the Martha Graham Academy. And even that only after a long spell of lackluster bidding. Not to mention some arm-twisting, Jimmy suspected, on the part of his dad, who'd known the Martha Graham president from their long-defunct mutual summer camp and probably had the dirt on him. Shagging smaller boys, dabbling in black-market pharmaceuticals. Or this was Jimmy's suspicion, in view of the ill grace and excessive force with which his hand was shaken.
"Welcome to Martha Graham, son," said the president, with a smile fake as a vitamin supplement salesman's.
"When can I stop being a son?" thought Jimmy.
"Not yet. Oh, not yet." "Attaboy, Jimmy," said his father at the garden party afterwards, giving him the arm punch. He had chocolate soy goo on his dweeby tie, which had a pattern of pigs with wings.
"Just don't hug me," Jimmy prayed.
"Honey, we're so proud of you,"
said Ramona, who'd come decked out like a whore's lampshade in an outfit with a low neckline and pink frills. Jimmy'd seen something like that on Hot Tots once, only it was worn by an 8-year-old. Ramona's push-up bra breast tops were freckled from too much sun, not that Jimmy was much interested in those anymore. He was familiar with the tectonics of cantilevered mammary gland support devices by now, and anyway he found Ramona's new matronly air repellent. She was getting little creases on either side of her mouth, despite the collagen injections. Her biological clock was ticking, as she was fond of pointing out. Pretty soon it would be the new skin's Botoxique treatment for her. Wrinkles paralyzed forever, employees half price. Plus, in say 5 years, the fountain of youth total plunge, which rasped off your entire epidermis. She kissed him beside the nose, leaving a smooch of cerise lipstick. He could feel it resting on his cheek, like bicycle grease. She was allowed to say we and to kiss him, because she was now officially his stepmother. His real mother had been divorced from his father in absentia, for desertion, and the bogus wedding of his father had been celebrated, if that was the word for it, soon after. Not that his real mother would have given a wombat's anus, thought Jimmy. She wouldn't have cared. She was off having cutting-edge adventures on her own, far from the dolorous festivities. He hadn't had a postcard from her in months. The last one had shown a Komodo dragon and had borne a Malaysian stamp, and had prompted another visit from the Corpsichore. At the wedding, Jimmy got as drunk as it took. He propped himself against a wall, grinning stupidly as the happy couple cut the sugary cake, all real ingredients, as Ramona had made known. Lots of cackling over the fresh eggs. Any minute now, Ramona would be planning a baby, a more satisfactory baby than Jimmy had ever been to anybody.
"Who cares? Who cares?" he'd whispered to himself.
He didn't want to have a father anyway, or be a father, or have a son, or be one. He wanted to be himself, alone, unique, self-created, and self-sufficient. From now on, he was going to be fancy-free, doing whatever he liked, picking globes of ripe life off the life trees, taking a bite or two, sucking out the juice, throwing away the rinds. It was Craik who'd got him back to his room. By that time, Jimmy had been morose and barely ambulatory.
"Sleep it off," said Craik in his genial fashion. "I'll call you in the morning."
Now here was Craik at the graduation garden party, looming up out of the crowd, shining with achievement. No, he wasn't, Snowman amends. Give him credit for that, at least. He was never a triumphalist. "Congratulations," Jimmy made himself say. It was easier because he was the only one at this gathering who'd known Craik well for any length of time. Uncle Pete was in attendance, but he didn't count. Also, he was staying as far away from Craik as possible. Maybe he'd finally figured out who'd been running up his internet bill. As for Craik's mother, she'd died the month before. It was an accident, or so went the story. Nobody liked to say the word sabotage, which was notoriously bad for business. She must have cut herself at the hospital, although, said Craik, her job didn't involve scalpels, or scratched herself. Or maybe she'd been careless and had taken her latex gloves off and had been touched on a raw spot by some patient who was a carrier. It was possible. She was a nail-biter. She might have had what they called an integumental entry point. In any case, she'd picked up a hot bioform that had chewed through her like a solar mower. It was a transgenetic staph, said some lab coat, mixed with a clever gene from the slime mold family. But by the time they'd pinned it down and started what they hoped would be effective treatment, she was in isolation and losing shape rapidly. Craik couldn't go in to see her, of course. Nobody could. Everything in there was done with robotic arms, as in nuclear materials procedures. But he could watch her through the observation window.
"It was impressive," Craik told Jimmy. "Froth was coming out."
"Froth? Ever put salt on a slug?" Jimmy said he hadn't.
Okay. So like when you brush your teeth.
His mother was supposed to be able to speak her last words to him via the mic system, said Craig. But there was a digital...